This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America, your source for Pan-African news and world developments. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
And I'm Yehisu Heap. Coming up on this hour, Africa News Tonight.
Well, the German authorities actually released some information to the state media last night, at midnight last night, saying that they have put out an arrest warrant for a young man by the name of Anis A. Now, the reason that they've used Anis A is because the convention here in Germany is to actually give the first name and the initial of the last name.
That's Brandon O'Shea in Berlin, Germany. Coming up, we'll have the latest developments on the search for the person responsible for the attack at a crowded Christmas market in Berlin.
Also, Gambian President Yahya Jammeh says he will not leave office next month when his term expires, and after security forces killed more than two dozen protesters in the DRC yesterday, sporadic gunfire is being reported in Kinshasa today.
We'll have these stories and lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight.
Our top story, German authorities continue to search for the person responsible for driving a truck into a crowded Christmas market in Berlin, a day after releasing a man who was arrested shortly after the attack that killed 12 people. German media said police are looking for a Tunisian man based on documents found in the truck. Berlin police say they have received more than 500 leads from a telephone tip line since the attack happened on Monday. Reporter Brandon O'Shea is covering the story from Berlin and provides us with the latest information.
Well, the German authorities actually released some information to the state media last night, at midnight last night, saying that they have put out an arrest warrant for a young man by the name of Anis A. Now, the reason that they've used Anis A is because the convention here in Germany is to actually give the first name and the initial of the last name. What they know about him is that he's 24 years of age, that he came to Europe into Italy last year. He was born in 1992, and that he travelled up to Germany and has actually had some encounters with the police already in August, so they know him. Now, at this stage, they've moved the search further across to area of state of Germany, North Rhine-Westphalia, which is where Cologne and Düsseldorf are, two rather big cities in Germany. And they have also broadened the search out in the whole sort of Schengen era. This is the Schengen Treaty area, which includes, of course, countries like Switzerland, Liechtenstein, Iceland, etc. That's what we know so far, that the police have issued this warrant for this man's arrest. Now, the reason they've done this is they actually found his living permit here for Germany in the cabin of the truck from the incident on Monday evening. This is why they're after him. They think also that he might be injured in some way, because you may recall there was a lot of blood in the cabin of the truck, and a lot of that blood wasn't just from the original driver of the truck, the Polish man, but actually from the other person that was with him at the time.
ISIS has claimed responsibility for this attack. Do you know if this person, was he working alone? I know the police have more than 500 leads on it.
That's right. They had more than 500 leads. And actually, we have been told to be very cautious about the fact that the so-called ISIS have actually claimed responsibility for this, because, first of all, there's a number of suspicious aspects surrounding this as well. The fact that it took so long for them to claim responsibility. And yes, they have contacted the authorities in the way that they normally do with a message, but the authorities here are also still waiting for proof that they actually were responsible for this particular incident. There is a large question mark still hanging around that aspect of it all. Whether this young man had connections with ISIS or not, I can't tell you at the moment.
And I guess since he did have a permit, then he was not part of the influx of migrants and refugees going into Germany?
Well, he came into Italy, first of all, so he possibly gained his residency permit there and then moved up, of course, without borders. He can move from Italy to Germany without too many problems at all. And that's quite possibly how he came to be here in Europe with this living permit.
What new security measures are being put into place since this has happened there?
There is a much greater police presence here on the ground. You will see police around the place on various corners, certainly in the center of town. That was happening actually before the attack on Monday. I personally noticed here in the capital that everywhere around most of the main stations, around many of the more renowned tourist spots, there were several police already standing there. Now, over in the area where this actually happened, it's a very famous area of Berlin, right in the heart of West Berlin. That area, of course, is cordoned off still with hundreds of police around the place. But having said that, they have managed to clear away a lot of the damage from Monday, and the other Christmas markets around Berlin, they have been opened again as of today. There is talk that possibly the Christmas market where this attack took place on Monday evening may open, if not tomorrow, the day after.
That's reporter Brendan O'Shea. He spoke with me from Berlin, Germany.
Gambian President Yahya Jammeh says he will not leave office next month when his term expires unless the Supreme Court rules on his election appeal. Although Jammeh initially conceded defeat to Adama Barrow in the December 1st election, he later claimed there were irregularities. AFP quotes Jammeh as saying, unless the court decides the case, there will be no inauguration of Barrow on January 19th. He says the only way justice can be served is to reorganize the elections so that every Gambian vote counts. He adds that is the only way the dispute can be resolved peacefully and fairly. Jammeh has ruled the Gambia for 22 years. African and international leaders have called on him to step down next month and accept the election results. However, he says he will not be intimidated.
Sporadic gunfire is being reported in Kinshasa today. This after security forces killed more than two dozen protesters in the Democratic Republic of Congo yesterday. Nationwide protests have erupted as President Joseph Kabila's election mandate expired yesterday. Balloting for a new president has not been organized, so Mr. Kabila plans to remain in power for at least another year. Human Rights Watch has confirmed at least 26 deaths during the protest, but that the actual number has been difficult to determine. HRW says Republican Guard soldiers conducted door-to-door searches, arresting youths and questioning others about their ties to the opposition.
There's a new armed group in Central African Republic that is raping and killing civilians. It's called 3R, which stands for Return, Reclamation, Rehabilitation. Human Rights Watch says it's wreaking havoc in the northwest of the country, displacing thousands of people. VOA's Jody Kapawa reports.
Since 2013, violence in Central African Republic has been blamed on three militant forces: the mostly Muslim Salika rebels, the mostly Christian anti-Balaka militias, and LRA rebels. But Human Rights Watch Africa researcher Louis Mudge says 3R is getting stronger and expanding its reach.
This is the first time that we're seeing a really serious rebel group emerge in the northwest of the country. They emerged in November 2015, but it was really in 2016 into September of this year that they've really started to get quite serious and aggressive in taking territory.
Members of 3R are ethnic Pul, or Fulani, Muslim herders who travel between Cameroon, southwestern Chad, and CAR.
Since 2013, we at Human Rights Watch documented many cases in which the Pul have been targeted by anti-Balaka militias, and they've suffered very, very serious human rights abuses themselves. And this group was established purportedly to protect the interests and the livelihoods of the Pul in the region. But what we've seen is actually they've committed very, very serious human rights abuses themselves.
Mudge describes some of the violence documented by Human Rights Watch during a 10-day trip to territory controlled by 3R.
We drove through numerous villages that had been burnt out and destroyed. We witnessed firsthand the displacement of tens of thousands of people, and many of these people are literally living in the bush with absolutely no assistance whatsoever. We spoke with witnesses and family members of civilians who were targeted and killed, including women and the elderly.
Human Rights Watch also spoke to rape victims. Mudge says none of the armed groups in Central African Republic have any qualms about harming civilians.
The reason is very, very simple. It's because there's absolutely no accountability for committing very serious crimes, including murder and rape, against civilians. These are war crimes. In many instances, these are crimes against humanity. And to date, we've not seen one rebel commander, we've not seen one rebel officer held to account for what he's commanded his or her men to do.
He says armed groups in CAR know that if they attack civilians, they're taken more seriously by UN peacekeeping troops and the Bangui government. There are nearly 13,000 UN peacekeepers in the country, but Mudge says they're stretched thin and need reinforcements. Making matters worse is the departure 6 weeks ago of the French peacekeeping mission. What's more, the government controls very little territory outside the capital. On the positive side, the European Union is training 2 battalions of government soldiers, while France and the U.S. are providing further training to U.N. forces. The crimes attributed to armed groups in CAR fall under the jurisdiction of the ICC, the International Criminal Court. But nothing has come of ICC investigations opened in late 2014. The HRW Africa researcher says, however, he's encouraged by a UNCAR special court consisting of national and international judges and prosecutors.
It was approved by the transitional government, and it's finally now in its early stages where we can actually expect this court to be up and running for the end of 2017. And that is probably the best case scenario for ensuring some degree of accountability for these very serious crimes that we've seen.
But for trials to be held, suspects must be arrested. Mudge says UN troops will probably bear responsibility for doing that. Joe DiCapua, VOA News, Washington.
You're listening to Africa News Tonight live on the following frequencies, 15, 580 and 6080 kilohertz on the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
I'm Yehisu Heap, 17 past the hour. Here's a recap of our top stories. Gambian President Yahya Jammeh says he will not leave office next month when his term expires. And after security forces killed more than 24 protesters in the DRC yesterday, sporadic gunfire is being reported in Kinshasa today. And for more news and information, visit our website at voaafrica.com.
Zimbabwe's currency crisis has had wide-ranging effects on the economy. In neighboring South Africa, home of the largest diaspora of Zimbabweans, some families are resorting to sending large amounts of cash by bus and carrier to their families back home. From Johannesburg, VOA's Anita Powell reports on Zimbabweans' creative ways to get cash.
Habuto Mabena is unusually nervous about this year's trip home to Zimbabwe, because this time, he is hand-carrying currency from South Africa to family members in the cash-strapped nation. Normally, he would send the funds by wire transfer from South Africa. But he and countless other expatriate Zimbabweans are resorting to creative, sometimes risky, measures as Zimbabwean banks rapidly run dry in the largest cash crisis the nation has seen in 7 years. Mabena, who works in Johannesburg, spoke to VOA from a bus en route to Zimbabwe. Before his own safety, he did not want to share details of his itinerary or cargo.
Not safe. It's not safe to pass. There's nothing that one can do. And I know some people that were not traveling, were now resorting to send their money to the drivers and so on. Most of this money gets lost along the way.
In 2009, Zimbabwe abandoned its wildly inflating dollar, making the U.S. dollar the dominant currency. Since then, the economy has worsened, unemployment has risen, the government has struggled to pay civil servants, and in recent months, banks have begun to run dangerously low on dollars. The government plans to print up to $200 million worth of bond notes, but Zimbabweans have widely shunned the local use-only bills, fearing they are a reincarnation of the doomed Zimbabwean dollar. The crisis has opened the door for creative, cashless solutions, like mobile phone banking. A South African wire transfer service recently introduced electronic payments to Zimbabwe in South African rand, which is legal tender in Zimbabwe, but not considered stable enough to be widely embraced. Co-founder of a South Africa to Zimbabwe transfer service called Mama Money, Rafael Gronowski lamented the cash crisis, but says it has provided new opportunities. In the past year, he says 20,000 new customers have joined Mama Money, with the average customer sending home about $100 per month in rand.
So we've seen since the cash crisis and people struggle to get cash, people are requesting electronic redemption a lot more because at least then they know the money has arrived in Zim and they can use it to buy for goods and services in store, buy electricity, buy airtime, and also cash out when there is an opportunity to cash out at a bank or at an ATM.
In Harare, business consultant Philip Ciccioni says the move to a cashless economy is not entirely bad, but said expatriates in foreign services cannot fix Zimbabwe's economic problems.
The economy needs to be fixed from the top. I think the government policies have to be aligned and have to be tuned to encourage production and investment in the country.
But most discussions about Zimbabwean policy eventually circle back to the man at the top, 92-year-old longtime president Robert Mugabe. His critics blame him for dismantling the once thriving economy during his 36-year rule. Earlier this month, Zimbabwe's ruling party announced that there is only one possible party candidate for president in 2018, Mugabe. Anita Powell, VOA News, Johannesburg.
Zimbabwe's second largest city is Bulawayo, an industrial center that turned into a ghost town when most city industries shut down. The only joyful sounds there today are the weekly praise songs of Pentecostal churches that fill some of the factories. Kudzidze Van Vash has the story about Bulawayo's vacant industrial parks.
It is 5 in the morning and operators of the city's combis are recruiting passengers who need to get to work. It is a different sight than I grew up with. A decade back, the combis filled quickly and easily and long lines of these vans streamed to and from the factories in what was then a vibrant industrial town. In those days, Bulawayo earned the name Kontutu Ziyathunga, which is Ndebele for the place that emits smoke. The smoke that rose above the factories proved that massive and continuous production was going on. Combis now search long and hard for the few customers who have jobs in Bulawayo, which now looks more like a ghost town. A ghost town that no longer emits much smoke. Bulawayo entrepreneur Zenzele Ndebele says the factory closures are the fallout from Zimbabwe's colonial era, when the government was under Ian Smith and this country was called Rhodesia.
There are a number of factors, basically, that have led to the industries in Bulawayo closing. Historically, we inherited a country which had industries that were centralized because of the sanctions. So you had the state playing a big role in running most of the companies, which we call parastatals today. Most of these companies that we inherited from Ian Smith were centralized.
Ndebele says when the Zimbabwean government gained its independence in 1980, the government did not really understand why the Rhodesian government was behind companies. That and mismanagement set the industries on its pathway to closure.
In 1980, when we inherited these companies, we really never understood why the state was behind the companies. So most of the guys who went into these companies, they started looting most of these companies. They started mismanagement, relatives that were not qualified, the boys from the war that were not qualified to run these companies were appointed to be CEOs, were appointed in the boards, and therefore we saw the companies starting to depreciate because there was no investment, but they were just milking what they already found.
Ndebele mentions some of the major industries that have collapsed in Bulawayo and countrywide, along with other factors that have contributed to it.
The National Railways collapsed, CSC collapsed, Zisco still collapsed. But also you find that economic collapse in the 2000, going for to the early 2000 up to now, also forced most of these companies to close because they were not producing.
Zimbabwe's economy, being agro-based, did not save the situation. When the government started its controversial land reform and experienced, white farmers were forced off their lands.
That Zimbabwe is an agriculture-based economy. So most of the industries that you find in Bulawayo basically depended on agriculture for raw material. The railway line was used to transport grain, to transport raw material to the industries. So the moment there was no agricultural activity after the 2005 invasions, it meant that business was not there for most of these companies.
They will add that some of these companies were shouldered out of business by technological advancements. The large Melin towel company is an example.
There are cheaper ways now to produce towels, for example. People no longer use nappies, they now use diapers, and Melin got irrelevant. China brought in new or cheaper ways of producing tires and other rubber products. Dunlop became irrelevant. So the technological advances made sure that some of these companies did not become useful, so we did not grow.
They really adds that other institutions found uses for the empty factories.
That we find ourselves left with empty shelves, empty industries, empty warehouses that have nothing happening in. And most of these places have become churches, of course. A lot of churches occupy these buildings. Some of them have become warehouses for NGOs when they distribute their food.
Such massive closures of industries had an impact on the people who live in Bulawayo, where some have adapted to a deteriorating economy.
In terms of how people are coping, it's actually, I mean, people are unemployed, is a fact. A lot of people have migrated to South Africa. A lot of people have migrated overseas. Some people have become vendors. In Bulawayo or in Zimbabwe, almost everyone is a vendor. People are selling something. Even those who are employed, you know, either they sell fish or they sell clothes. Someone is selling something because their salaries cannot sustain themselves.
Debele says Zimbabwe's failing economy has affected other parts of the country as well.
Countrywide companies are closing. Zisco Steel in Kwekwe closed. Shabani Mine closed. So a lot of companies across the country have been closing because the economy is not doing well.
The Zimbabwean government has expressed confidence that the economy will pick up soon following various efforts to attract foreign direct investment. One such case is that of special economic zones that will provide an investor-friendly economy in Zimbabwe. The ZANU-PF government is under pressure to perform as Zimbabwe presidential elections are billed for the year 2018. This is Kudzai Nawashe, reporting for Voice of America from Harare.
In Nigeria, a months-long investigation into a billion-dollar deal with petroleum companies has resulted in corruption charges being filed. Former oil minister Dan Etete and former justice minister Muhammad Adoke, along with other officials and a businessman, are facing money laundering charges. They stem from a deal with petroleum companies to develop an oil block. That's a large area of land awarded to oil drilling and exploration companies. Nigeria's Anti-Corruption Commission says the money ended up in the account of a local oil company partly owned by Etete. The charges were filed yesterday in the five-year-old scandal. Nigeria's OPL 245 oil reserve is considered the richest in Africa. It's located in waters off the southern part of the Niger Delta, about 2,000 meters below the surface. The U.S., Britain, and other countries are also investigating.
And that wraps up this edition of Africa News Tonight. Stay tuned for Straight Talk Africa with Shaka Sali coming up at 18:30 UTC. I'm Yais Wuhib in Washington.
And I'm Kim Lewis. And for all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at www.voaafrica.com. On behalf of our Africa News Tonight producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, Rob McLean, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
On the next Straight Talk Africa, the 2016 year in review, we'll take a look at some of the continent's major events and happenings. We'll discuss Africa's political landscape and some of the challenges its leaders faced in 2016. That's right here on the next Straight Talk Africa at 18:30 UTC.
The Voice of America. America, VOA.